This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by Berry Brothers and Rudd, Britain's oldest wine and spirit merchant. It isn't possible at the moment to go to your favourite restaurant because restaurants are closed. But Berry Brothers and Rudd have nobly stepped into the breach with their fantastic new at-home service. Berry's will send a magnificent three-course meal directly to your house, and they'll also provide the ideal wine or wines to go with the food. What a delicious idea. Go to spectator.co.uk/Berry Brothers to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Lyra Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Alison Roman. Alison is an American food writer and cook. Having chefed at restaurants including New York's Mama Fuku Milk Bar, she began working at Bon Appetit, where she ultimately became senior food editor. She is the author of the best-selling cookbooks Dining In and Nothing Fancy. Alison, thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alison, we always start this podcast in the same place. We always ask, what was food like when you were growing up?
What was food like for me growing up? That's funny, I was just writing about that. You know, my parents, both of them, they cooked quite a bit, but it was sort of like, you know, equal parts ordering pizza and cooking at home. So I feel like I got a really great food education. But it was, I mean, I grew up in California, in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, a lot of salmon and brown rice and asparagus and things like that, which I feel like are very Californian, stereotypically. We didn't have any rituals. It wasn't like a Sunday supper type of energy. It was more just like, you know, it was clear to me from a young age that my parents cared about food and eating. And yeah, it was, I have, you know, interesting food memories, but nothing too sentimental, I guess.
And were you a good eater as a child or were you fussy?
No, I've only gotten fussier as I've gotten older. I was a pretty good eater. I think that the only foods that I didn't care for, I didn't like cilantro or coriander growing up, but now I love it. And I could not stand bananas. But other than that, I think I ate pretty much everything. My mom had this rule where I had to eat one bite of everything. Not so cleverly named the one bite rule, but it was sort of just ensured that I would always try everything. Even if I thought I didn't like it, I had to try it to then make sure that I didn't like it.
And did you learn to cook with your mother?
I think we learn a lot of things from our parents just by watching and sort of through osmosis. But yeah, I mean, I think that I didn't really start learning how to cook until later in life, in high school, and I, you know, reading cookbooks and then working in restaurants. Like, that's how I really learned how to cook. You know, when you grow up without the internet, there's fewer resources. So it's like, you know, my parents didn't have a ton of cookbooks or anything like that, but there were magazine articles and things like that that I would read. And my mom had a few like hits that she made, and I definitely learned how to make those from her.
Tell us about those. What kind of things would she make?
There was always like a steamed artichoke with garlic butter, and she would do this trout where, you know, you take like a whole trout butterflied and mix breadcrumbs with melted butter and garlic and herbs and then spread it on the trout and then broil it. So it got really crispy on top and then really perfectly cooked fish on the bottom. And that was always my favorite thing. And I actually put that recipe in Dining In because I felt like it was important to the development of me as a cook.
What's school food like in an LA high school? Do you take your own food? Do you eat on campus?
It was sort of like when you got your driver's license, you were allowed to go off campus to go eat lunch. But I rarely did. I sort of just stuck around, my friends and I. I forget why. I didn't have a car until like later in senior year. But yeah, it was sort of like, you know, bringing your own food. And I actually have no memory of what my food experience was in high school. And nobody has ever asked me that. That is a first.
And what about holidays? You've written about doing Thanksgiving on a small scale in a Brooklyn apartment. Were holiday meals a big deal as a child?
Thanksgiving was sort of always the biggest holiday in my family. My parents were separated, but at my dad's house, that was always the most important holiday. My grandfather was Jewish and my grandmother was Catholic. So, you know, celebrating Christmas and Hanukkah always felt like we were doing it halfway. But Thanksgiving was the one holiday that was non-denominational and that everybody really felt like they could get behind. And so it was his favorite holiday, and then it became my dad's favorite holiday, and now it's my favorite holiday. But less so about the food. I didn't really begin to love holidays until I started making my own holidays, like when I moved out of the house and would sort of host in my own way. But now when I do go home, or, you know, when I was going home, they become more important to me now, because now I feel like I'm cooking for my family, which feels really nice.
You left college to go and work in the restaurant industry. Tell us about that initial move.
Yeah, I sort of had felt like I really ran my course in school. I knew that it didn't spark anything in me that made me want to stay. I think that I was doing a ton of reading and writing on my own and, you know, was very engaged in like current events and had friends that we were constantly talking about like really wonderful topics. And I felt like I was very stimulated intellectually. And then when I was in class, I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel like growing as a person. I didn't feel like I was learning a ton. I just don't think my heart was in it. Weird. I mean, I know I've spoken to some people where they were like, I really loved college. I loved sitting in classes and learning, and it just never clicked for me. And I felt like I wanted to be better spending my time doing something like actionable. And so for me, that sort of started as like, okay, I was cooking in my spare time. I was cooking to learn more how to cook just by reading books and doing it for myself. And, you know, I decided that I was going to go try and work at a restaurant because I figured I could always go back to college, but I could not replicate the feeling that I had, which was this sort of sense of urgency of like, you need to begin your life right now, and it needs to start by cooking professionally.
And tell us about working in restaurants initially. Did you immediately feel you'd found your vocation, or was it hard? Tell us all about it.
Both. Yeah. it was definitely hard, but I loved it. When I first started cooking, so I approached a chef at a restaurant that I had eaten at a few times that I really loved. It was like a very high-end fine dining restaurant. And I basically asked for a job. And I said, I'm going to go to culinary school and I'd love to work here while I'm in school. But he told me to not go to culinary school and that I should just start working for him. And so that's what I did because, you know, again, the logic being if you don't like it, you're not out $40,000 or how much ever it costs now. But I was so bad at it because working in a restaurant requires so much rhythm and knowledge about like the ecosystem of the restaurant. You have to be so mindful of the people around you and their work schedule. And it's not just, you're not just working in a vacuum. And so I cried every day after work. I cried. I was just so bad at it, but I really loved it. And it didn't, no matter how much I was upset or emotional about being bad at this job, it never once occurred to me to not do it. It never occurred to me to quit or to not come back the next day because I really loved it. And I knew that one day I could get the hang of it. Like I just knew that it was going to take a while. And it did. It did take a while.
And you started off on the pastry section, I think, in that first restaurant. Was that by accident or design?
Definitely an accident. It was just the only position they had open. So I would have taken any job that they had offered me, but they didn't have any availability. It was a really small and intimate kitchen. It was like, I want to say maybe 7 cooks and then 2 people in the pastry department. And so I started off at their, like the restaurant had a sister bakery across the street. And so I started off there, basically waited for somebody to leave. And the first person to leave was in the pastry department. And so that's the job that I took.
And I mean, it sounds like you obviously had been always very interested in food writing and cookery books. But how did you then make the move from working in restaurants into the world of food writing?
I had sort of exhausted myself in the restaurant world. I had been there for like 6 or 7 years. And so I started off in Los Angeles. I moved to San Francisco. I worked there. And then I moved to New York. Was working there. And I sort of moved to New York with the idea that I wasn't going to work in restaurants anymore. But of course, in order to make a living, I needed a job. And my skill was to work in restaurants. So I got a job in restaurants. But about after 1.5 years, I left Momofuku to go just kind of explore what the possibilities were. And I found myself getting hired as a freelancer at Bon Appetit. This was years ago. And I was a recipe tester, essentially. So you know, they would cook the recipes and I would cook them again to make sure that they worked. And that was sort of the only role they had for me for like a full year. And then being at the magazine made me realize that that was sort of like a very niche world in which I could both cook and write at the same time, because I had gone to school for writing and sort of always, and you know, I enjoyed it. I thought it was something that came naturally to me. I never thought I would do it professionally. I just didn't think that was a possibility. And so now I sort of saw this world where like the two things that I loved and wanted to pursue could be possible at the same time.
And who are the food writers that you admire or were reading when you were getting into this kind of world?
I was reading a lot of memoirs and a lot of, you know, biographies and things like that. Judith Jones, she's actually an editor, but she did her fair amount of writing as well. She wrote a book called The Tenth Muse that really, really inspired me. It was like my first year working at the magazine, and her love of food was just so no bullshit and like very earnest. But she was also very strong and opinionated, and I really resonated with that. Like, it didn't feel like she wasn't writing superfluously. There was no fluff about it. It was very much like who she was, and it was just coming out of her very naturally. And I really connected with, because I felt like when I was right, there's some writers that are beautiful writers and they've chosen to write about food, whereas I feel like I'm sort of doing it backwards. Like, I would say that I'm a cook first and then a writer second. So it just kind of comes out in a very natural way. It doesn't make me the best writer, but I do think that there's, you know, a level of authenticity there that I saw in her writing that I really admired.
You're obviously very well known for your recipes, which you now write, written them for the New York Times. You have your own Instagram page, which is hugely popular. How do you now go about creating recipes? Is it exactly the same process as when you were working at Bon Appetit, or have you kind of tweaked the process?
No, I mean, I haven't been at Bon Appetit for like 5 years. And so I think that if you, like any person, it's like, where were you 5 years ago? 5 years feels like an eternity now. And I think that, you know, even writing for the New York Times, I feel like my style is different now, that I'm writing pretty much just for myself. But I think that any time that I would write a recipe, whether it was for a magazine or for a newspaper or for a book, I'm sort of writing it for that specific publication. And you're writing it for that audience, and you're writing it for the people that you are working with and collaborating with and who are publishing you. Now I publish mostly, I'm working on another cookbook, which I always treat as like their own thing. Like, cookbooks to me are very sacred, and I develop recipes for those books in a very specific way. But now I'm sort of in this phase where I'm writing for myself, and I have a newsletter that I publish every week, and those have recipes and sort of longer stories and narrative essays, and I'm just having a really good time with it. Like, it feels very fun to me again. And I'm sort of recalibrating not only my writing style, but my cooking style. Like, what are the foods that I actually want to eat? Because I'm not beholden to an editorial calendar, and I'm developing recipes kind of like the week that I'm publishing them sometimes. So it feels very relevant, and it feels very like, you know, it's less flashy, but it feels more honest.
I was just going to ask how the pandemic has affected the way you think about recipe writing. You've sort of been opened up to this new audience of people who haven't necessarily had the same cooking acumen that previous food writing readers have. Have you changed the way you approach the recipes that you're putting out?
No, I sort of feel like I've always been really mindful of home cooks of any skill level. I want people to have success with the recipes, whether or not you cook every night or you're just getting started. But with that also comes, like, I also want the recipes to be interesting and engaging enough for the people that have been cooking every night for years. You know, I think that sort of nailing that intersection of new people that are less confident and seasoned cooks and all that, and sort of trying to make something for everybody is always my goal. And I don't always achieve that goal, but I do try. And I think that, like, you know, if you approach recipe writing from like a really honest place where, you know, here's what I'm inspired by, here's what I'm eating, here's what I want to be cooking right now, that resonates with people. And so I think that I'm really trying to lean into not getting distracted by what I think people want and just continuing to be as honest as possible. Because I think once you start like designing for what you think people want, it becomes a little muddied, right? There's something inauthentic about it, or you're trying to do something that, I don't know, I feel like you're cheating yourself out of like your own creativity.
And are there certain recipes that you've noticed have been particularly popular during the last year?
Yeah, there was a recipe for a shallot pasta that did really well. I've been seeing a lot of that. It was, I think, the New York Times most popular recipe of the full year, which really meant a lot because I feel like, especially in a pandemic, when we are not feeling our best, and it was a really tough year. And so I think that the idea that people were still excited about cooking something and wanting to share that with people really meant a lot. It felt like people really trusted me to like bring them some amount of happiness during this weird time. And I do not take that responsibility lightly. And I feel that made me feel really good.
And how many times with that recipe have you had to field questions about what people can use other than a whole tin of anchovies?
More than I care to count. I like to say that if you don't like anchovies, you should still try it because I think it's more of a mental block for some people than anything. But if you're a vegetarian and you don't eat fish, then you can use, you know, something like miso paste a little bit, or, you know, try other recipes. It is such a bulk of the dish that I really hate being without it, but I have heard some vegetarians say that they've been extremely happy with the results using miso paste instead of anchovies.
That's good to hear. And what's your relationship like with social media and food? I mean, do you think social media has been a force for good in the world of food?
Oh gosh, yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I think if you had asked me a year ago, I would have said 100%, and now I'd probably say 50%. I think that it's a great way to share things. And if you are taking a picture of something and you post it and other people see it, I mean, it's been such an amazing marketing tool for my cookbooks because other people will look at my cookbooks and they see the photos in the books. Okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. But then they see other people cooking those same dishes and they look like the photo in the book. And I think that inspires them to want to make it. They say, oh, well, that looks just like the book. I could do that too. And they can do it. And then they do it. And then they share it. And then somebody else sees it. And so it's like, if you make a recipe that looks beautiful and it works when people make it, they're going to want to share it. They're proud of that. And they should be. That's like a wonderful accomplishment. And so I think that in that regard, it is like sort of the last pure place on the internet where you're just like, I made this delicious dinner and I wanted other people to see it. Like, that feels really nice to me. There's, of course, other darker corners of social media that I would rather not ever deal with ever again. But I think if we're talking about like the purity of sharing something that you've cooked and you're proud of, I think it's a wonderful thing that exists.
I know we can't have people around at the moment in the way that we used to, but I want to ask you about what makes a good host. And I don't mean entertaining, because I know that like napkins and tablescapes are not your bag, and I'm very much with you on that. But like, what makes a good supper with friends? How do you create a really great one?
I always start with the first thing that I'm going to make. Like, what do I feel like eating? Is it a stew? Is it a chicken? Is it a piece of fish? And then I kind of work around that to make sure everything works together, but not overthinking it. I think that, like, you know, having plenty of wine, if you drink, is really helpful. I'm huge on ambiance. Like, if there's not a candle in the room, I can't really feel relaxed. Sort of just making it a space that you want to be in. I think especially because, I mean, yeah, it's tough because we're not doing that right now. So I feel like I'm even rusty in figuring out what to say about this. But just less is more. And I think that when we are going to be able to be in each other's homes again, I think that there's going to be this huge move to just like hang out with each other indoors in a way that we maybe took for granted before. Well, we definitely took for granted before. And I think that it's less about the performance and more just like, we want to eat something really delicious. We want there to be good energy. There's good music playing. There's nice lighting. You know, we have wine. It's like back to basics.
Mm. And when you're home by yourself, what's your comfort food? What do you enjoy cooking for yourself?
When I'm home by myself, which is now all the time, honestly, I've gotten really into just making like a very small amount of pasta with like a personal pasta portion when I'm feeling like I really need something like hyper comforty. It's sort of like whatever's in my fridge. If there's greens left over, I'll throw that in. The other day I made one that was just, what was it? It was like kale and tons of Parmesan and black pepper and spaghetti. And it was one of the best things I've ever eaten. You know, it's not the kind of recipe that I think needs to be published. It's pretty simple, but it really made me so happy to be eating it. And I was like, wow, so basic and boring, but really so perfect. And I feel like in quarantine, especially, I found myself gravitating to really simple, simple flavors and pastas and sort of getting back to basics and like, how can I create something that just tastes surprisingly good with like five ingredients? You know, that feels really exciting to me, that sort of challenge.
And what about snacks? Do you have a favorite snack?
Oh gosh, my favorite snacks. I am an equal opportunist when it comes to snacks. I go through phases. Like right now I'm eating a lot of cottage cheese, like on crackers or with eggs or in an omelet or something. I feel like that's like a snack for me. And I really love like sort of eggs in any situation, but like a jammy egg with like a tin of sardines and some pickled onions with like, you know, sort of like a working lunch energy, because I feel like I'm glued to my laptop these days and I will just make like a small plate of multiple snacks, different combinations that I can just pick at over the course of an hour. I feel like that's where I'm at.
And I mean, I'm assuming that lots of restaurants are closed at the moment in New York, but when things hopefully reopen, where will you be heading to first?
Oh my gosh, I'll be going to Keen's Steakhouse probably, which is like a really old steakhouse in Midtown in Manhattan. The thing I miss most about restaurants isn't the food, it's the energy of being in a restaurant. I also really miss sushi. I haven't had like a good sushi experience in a long time, and I really miss that because that's not something that I would ever do for myself or even know how to. I wouldn't even know where to start. But you know, there's amazing takeout options here in New York. And I've gotten incredible Thai food and Szechuan food and Lebanese food. And the flavors and the food are not what I miss, because that's still happening and I still have access to it. What I miss is like the energy of being in a room with other people, again, with great lighting and a martini. And I will go to the places that have the best vibe is the short answer.
Sounds very sensible.
And what about a desert island meal? What is your ultimate one meal? It can be restaurant, takeaway, something you cook, something someone else cooks for you. What's your ultimate?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Desert island meal. I feel like it really, right now it's very cold here in New York, and I'm feeling like my body is powering down for the winter. And I feel like unless it has like a carbohydrate and a cheese on it, I'm not interested. But it's been a really long time since I've had like perfect pizza, and which seems weird because I have theoretically access to it, but I haven't had it. And my body has been thinking about it every day for about a week. So right now that's what I'll say. That is my meal. But other than that, I feel like it's like a steakhouse meal. Like I want shrimp cocktail with a martini and extra olives. I want like a crispy baked potato with sour cream. And I want a really beautiful, like perfectly rare steak.
Sounds delicious. Alison, thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.